the wizard.
Am I coming through, guys?
Yeah,
yeah, you're good.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff there that got touched on. You know, some very interesting puzzles. I was interested in that whole 1130 thing that John was talking about. And David, you will relate to this automatically. I'm not sure about you other guys, but it occurs to me, because remember how we were talking before on Facebook about the L's of Lilith being reversed, like the double L?
Sure.
The upside down Lamed, right, could be the minute hand, the long hand that extends down, right?
Uh-huh.
So that 1130 then gives you that upside down Lamed, basically.
Sure.
I just think that's interesting in terms of this idea of because as the discussion continues, we go from like more solid concepts into more what I would call, entertaining ones, perhaps. But there does seem to be something here about, and you mentioned, Alan, about the whole Valis loop. There seems to be something here about the movement of a tape along or across multiple heads, if you know what I mean, perhaps twisting and turning. If you could think. Yeah, if you could think of it like Bill, I know you might be able to dig this too, because if you thought of it like a Rubik's Cube, but the tape head could go anywhere in the cracks, right? So it could follow through any crack on a Rubik's Cube, including internal cracks, presuming, of course, that it was the entire thing was solid cubes all the way to the center, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a tape head moving across the top of, say, a corner of a Rubik's Cube, and then down into one crack and then into the center and all sorts of things. And I'm just interested in this in terms of, because there's so many stuff that we've gone over here. And we were talking about the number 17 before. And I'm mentioning this to you guys and to anybody who might listen to this, because I think this is something that would be really worth investigating. And obviously, many heads are better than one, which is kind of ironic since we're talking about tape heads here. But so I know that may seem a bit of a digression. But so you have this idea. No, because John, it's a pity he's not here, although he'd probably just make this as vague as possible as soon as I brought it up. But he talks about these 17 U-turns that take place inside The Shining, basically. I've matched them up to the Apollo moon missions, of which there were 17, or the Apollo missions, of which there were 17. And it's quite an interesting correlation. But each of these ideas of going, for instance, Wendy's, the 10th, 11th, and 12th are Wendy as she winds her way up the stairwell and eventually confronts the bear, which John himself believes, and I know because he said it on this very show, is actually Wendy herself. Wendy is the one who's dressed up in the bear costume. So it's like she's looking in the mirror, right? And this idea of mirrors and the way in which an idea or perhaps time itself can be reflected or like light, right? And then pushed along a mirror's edge. And not at all ironically, that image is present on the Dark Side of the Moon album cover too. The way light is, pushed along an angle when it's passed through some kind of medium, basically. So we might be presuming the same thing about time, and I think that's kind of interesting in terms of the concept of the Valis loop and of reversing time. Is John coming back, or is it just us? Until, or are we going to ride it out?
I think he's done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'd be interested in your guys' ideas about that, about the idea that time is kind of being redirected or something along those lines.
You know, if I may just tell you real quickly, I had a crazy set of synchronicities yesterday that touch on all this stuff. My wife's family, her sisters and her parents were in town for just one day. My wife was in a dance show and they came in town. They came into town to see the performance. So my wife goes early to the show. We have to go a few hours later. So I'm sitting there playing this game with her sisters and her mom, and it's this game with these like colored pieces. And one of the things I think about, I realize that I need a piece which is a blue star. So I think about Sirius and my own personal connections with Sirius, and I think, well, come on, I got to get the blue star piece. Come on, man, that's my shit, right? And right away I get it, and it's weird because depending on how you play in this particular game, you get different point values. I get it, use it on my turn, and I get 17 points. For me, I see 17 as the star of Sirius. So I get my blue star, and I get the number 7, and I get 17 points. I'm like, oh, that's perfect. Meanwhile, while I'm doing this, her sister, in between when it wasn't her turn, she's sitting there playing with a Rubik's Cube. And then she pulls out a second cube. So I'm playing with one, she's playing with one. So I have Rubik's Cubes, blue stars, 17s, all this sort of stuff. Then I go to my wife's show. It was the first time I was going to get to see it. And they start off with this like weird narration, and it says that when people die, sometimes when people die, they don't go to heaven or hell, they become mermaids. And here I'm thinking about the movie Head, which of course starts with them jumping, cutting the tape, and jumping off the bridge, falling into the water with the mermaids. And just like shit like that. Like it was just insane. So like listening to you guys talk today, it's like, it's all just like yesterday was just another version of this. Is that the Valis loop, or is it that there's these, that's just one interpretation of it. Just another idea that here's this sort of same signs echoing again today as they were yesterday.
Yeah,
fantastic.
You know, yeah. So the heads thing, right? So I've been tripping out on the fact that you have Hebrew letters, Resh and Kuf. Resh represents the front of the head, or the medial front of the head, while the medial back of the head is represented by Kuf. And so there's this whole fiction there.
Can I stop you?
Because
I'm not sure your pronunciation. Kuf
no,
sounds
it's,
like
it's it is it's Kuf.
Well, what number is that in the alphabet?
What is that? 18 or something? It's like they're right next. Yeah, so it's 18, and then Resh is 19. I'm actually like I don't know all Greek. I don't know a lot of things, but the Hebrew letters.
No. I just know the Hebrew alphabet too, but I didn't recognize that pronunciation, so I was just curious.
That's the rabbi's pronunciation right there.
So that's 18. Okay, all right, it's cool.
I know, it's so funny because when you look at the European occultist representation of things, it can be a little you're led on to think it's one thing because of the particular way in which it's spelled, but it's actually Kuf. Anyways, so Kuf and Resh relate to the sun and the moon. So you have the back of the head is related to the moon in tarot. So if you do the European correspondences, you have Resh is the front of the head, and then which is the sun, and then Kuf is the back of the head, which is the moon. And so it's interesting here what happens, first of all, when you overlay the two of them together with 50-50 transparency from the Thoth deck, which I find really fascinating. But the fact that you have this beetle in the center of the card between the two pillars, which reoccur in the 13th card, which is known as Death, was originally the major arcana to be untitled. I find this really kind of strange, this whole idea of the two towers and Death and the beetle, and then relating that to literally both sides of the head, which I could easily take the Kuf as representing the pineal gland, whereas Resh representing the pituitary gland. And so you have the two third eyes, so to speak. You know, I know that sounds like a contradiction, but because they're medial alignments, one eclipses the other, which is just perfect in symbolism for the sun and the moon. Does any of that make any sense to you guys?
Well, yeah, that hits home big time, big time. That's brilliant. Yeah, and you know, as you were explaining that, I started to try to think about the movement of this tape that I see on this Rubik's Cube, and I can see that it very much mimics the kind of coiling curves of the human brain tissue itself.
Sure.
If you follow my meaning, like some kind of almost like a Shanghai noodle squiggling through space, basically. So that's pretty, that makes sense. So I've got to do that experiment myself, because maybe I've been thinking only from the back of my head, because I've become very moon oriented lately. But that is a very cool idea. So yeah, five stars.
If you look at the two of discs, which happens to just be sitting in front of me, I'm looking at the two of discs from the Marte Tarot. So one of the earlier, obviously, forms of the tarot. You can see they have like this piece of tape that literally looks like VHS tape scrolling through these two discs, which look like wheels. There's kind of the two of discs is a significant card that would be changed for Crowley with the serpent doing a figure eight, which is literally the Valis loop, right? You can see what card I'm talking about. But it's interesting to look at that in the Marseille Tarot. You have this snake is just represented as this piece of tape. It's kind of trippy.
No, that's fantastic. It really is, because then you have if the two wheels would represent the numerical ration kuf, the moon, one sure. being the front head, one being the front head, and the other being the back head. So we're talking about the transfer of magnetic information. This is that's fantastically brilliant there, David. That's really good.
Hey. Go ahead. It's the idea of the wheels and the tape. That's what I was thinking about with John's new video, which is every U-turn in The Shining. Well, what is the U-turn? It's the flipping of the tape, right? And those U-turns are being done by Danny on his wheels, on his big wheels.
And that's other the characters, wheels. Yeah. But no, go ahead. No, sorry, Al, you go ahead, please.
I want to include something for you to ponder, because I'd like your answer on it. So it's like the idea that specifically his it's a tricycle, right? He has three wheels,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm just wondering if that changes anything in your assessment of
absolutely because what? Okay, all right. You're asking me about my moon code stuff, basically now, and yes, it does because. The tricycle represents the tetrahedron, right, with Danny's head being the top point, right? And when he's riding around on his first big wheel ride, we see the words camera walk on a sign, right? So we're talking about the eye on top of a solid geometrical tetrahedron, which is the first of the platonic solids, the first geometrical shape of three dimensions that can appear. We're talking about it moving through space with an eye on top of it, like a camera on a tripod, or like very much like early filmmakers making movies. I mean, this is how brilliant Kubrick was in regards to this kind of imagery, right? Are you following me so far?
Yeah.
So this, but it also represents what I believe, or what I am in my moon theory right now. And I believe me, I'm ready to have this challenged. But the idea that the moon is a central principle, basically. So you have this idea of the camera lens, which both, and I wanted to get into this with John in terms of the idea of time reversing too, because I think it might have to do with the way in which light is captured by the eye at a single point, and then it's spread out into a likewise map in the brain, each representing, you know, so it converges like a pyramid at the point of the eye, right? And then it opens up into the brain like a reverse pyramid. And of course, everything that we have in our brain is a memory of the past instantaneously. So therefore, it's a memory of death, right? It's a memory of something that is gone, that we can only relive in terms of memory or replay like we do on a tape, right? So we have this idea now of the brain being a tape, which is really well illustrated by David's model. But does that answer your question, Alan?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, I think...
So the big wheel represents the tripod, is what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was just curious. So if it's, I guess my thing was, if it was like a piece of, I don't know, it's, I don't know if it's something too, if I'm sort of overthinking it, but the idea of, you know, here we have this tape being played on sort of, you know, you can picture your standard reel to reel is two wheels. But I guess there is a lot of times that I have a very clear image in my mind. I don't know if you guys are familiar with like old school editing, but on a reel to reel, you sort of have the Mickey Mouse ears.
Yes, absolutely. Which is actually it's really a halo, right? This is what the Mickey Mouse ears are. They're actually a halo in cross section. You just cross-section the halo so that you only see the two parts of it that appear to be coming forward, right? Do you understand how those two spheres sitting there represent a kind of a halo? And the halo then, in turn, becomes the toroid model, right? The bagel shape or the donut shape. And then as you press this, as this form expands, it becomes a spheroid or a hypersphere. And essentially, it's like a super inflated bagel, right? Over leavened. And of course, bagels aren't leavened, right? That's where the leaven of malice in the Bible comes from, right? It's this bagel has grown oversized by its leavening. And now the hole in the middle is infinitesimally small. And then you have the exterior, which represents the same nothingness. So now, in terms of the tape, what you have is going, the two heads then are the minimal point at the center, which is invisible, and then the exterior point, which is also invisible because we are on the inside of this toroid model. We are on the tape loop that moves along the interior surface of this toroid model, touching these two heads, one of them infinitesimally small at the center, one of them extremely, impossibly infinitesimally large at the exterior. And we're on the inside, sliding around like tape. Now, so you have a multiplicity of infinities, right? The tape's going back and forth in infinite loops, crossing over each other. And does that make some sense?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to, because of your interest in 17, and I mean, I'm just telling you what I know about 17 now, because I haven't connected it to Sirius, but this is a very interesting idea, because in my current theory, Sirius represents this exterior limit, okay? It's almost like it's a 360-degree movie theater projection. Mm-hmm. At the very center of it, at the exact dead center, is the moon, which is an imaginary light that shines out these rainbow colors, broken up as light passes through, a white light passes through the prism. And then they are projected onto the exterior sphere at their limit of the interior Sirius, basically. Now, you've connected this idea of Sirius to 17. I don't know why it is that you've done that, but I'm interested in this, because let me go there. So you have these 17 Apollo missions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each time. And what these represent are imaginary attempts to breach this exterior sphere. In other words, to go out.
Mark, can I just want to say this. If this maybe simplifies things for you, Sirius and the moon, I would agree, are intimately connected. So if you see 17 as the moon, I see 17 as Sirius, I think we're probably in agreement. I see them as that they go hand in hand. If you look at the moon tarot card, you have the dogs there. And some people have even referred to Sirius as the sort of moon, in the sense like the moon to our solar system. You know, it's the satellite, or are we the satellite of it? Blah blah blah. There's a correlation there. I just wanted to say that I don't. For me, I focus on the Sirius aspect, but I think the moon is 100% there. I just want to throw that out to you, is to say that I think we're very much in agreement. I think we're very much.
Of course, the moon is there. The moon is the moon is there. It is in my I think it is the center point. It's an imaginary center point. But that's, I wanted to get into this whole 17 thing, just kind of expand a bit what I know about 17, and see how you react to it.
Sure. Before you go into, real quick, because I don't want to forget something you said there. Before you go to 17, just to say, when you said 17 as the sort of projector point, you know, the source point, I just, for whatever it's worth, I have to tell you that there was a few years ago, I had taken a bunch of hashish. I'd eaten a bunch of hashish, probably a little too much. And I was standing out on my roof at night, and I'm looking up into the night sky, and I suddenly realized it was like being in a movie theater and being turned around and seeing this projector in the back. Like, you know, okay, here's this black wall, and then there's this one bright projector light. And I'm standing on my roof, and I looked up, and I'm like, there's a projector. it was I was I had this total realization, oh my God, this is like an illusion. This is a hologram projected, and I'm looking up at this at the projector, and then I realize, oh fuck, that's Sirius. The Sirius was shining so bright, and in my hallucinatory state, which of course exaggerates that brightness and that light difference, I was completely made aware in that moment that that was the projector. I don't know if I take that to be literal in my, you know,
no, I think you're on the
assessment
money.
of reality, but
well,
you're correct. There's definitely a truth there.
Well, yeah. you know, it's funny because in your description, you mentioned being turned around, right? And like how you turn. So yeah. I think what you're experiencing here under the influence, quite frankly, is the experience of spinning. You're having a Sufi kind of expression. And I think you're confusing, or not confusing, but you're melting together the concept of the projected world and the projector of that world into a single expression, basically, which you have identified as Sirius. That's how I see this. And I mean, the reason I say that is because just of the conceptual idea of Sirius as an immense star. It's enormous, right? Like it stretches, yeah. It would stretch well into our, yeah. And then the idea of the moon as a small central point. But basically, I don't disagree with you in terms of like, you know, this is how I interpret the opening image of 2001. It's a small discovery that I consider to be originates with me. I'm sure it's out there with others, but I just haven't found it. Is that this opening image is actually, it's the light of a projector, right? That's what the so-called sun is. And in the middle, you have this spherical thing, which is actually the head of a person watching the movie. And then you have the screen appear as the last thing. And you, as the viewer of this image, are actually placed up and above and over the screen as if you're looking down from it from the other side. So this completes a complete mirror image. Now you are the projectionist. You're a mirror image of the projectionist looking in on the image as it projects an image on the screen. You see what I mean? It's just it's extraordinarily brilliant how Kubrick does this.
Jason, made a similar connection, which just blew me the fuck away once I saw it, is that in Clockwork Orange, you know, there's that opening scene where they go and they attack the homeless man under the tunnel?
Yes.
If you look there, you have this, of course, they're completely backlit by this bright light. And then there's this cobblestone road, which, of course, goes into this very sharp focal point visually. And literally is those stones, when you look at it, it's like they're this kind of tannish color. It is a pyramid. It is an illuminated pyramid, like very literally. But then it's mirrored again later in the movie when you keep seeing him with the movie projector behind him. So it's
like over and over again throughout the entire movie. Actually, you'll find pyramids, even to the point where there's literally like a cap pyramid fucking eye in the prison when he gets chosen for the actual Clockwork Orange. He like if you look behind, you'll see that there's like it's not subtle at all. It's weird.
I just like the idea.
That's great. Yeah,
I like the idea that is the projector. Like it's not only an illuminated pyramid and taking you to things like Illuminati and etc. It's also taking you to the idea as the projector, the movie theater projector being the same thing. He's making a direct correlation.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Jason Barrera, for that, because I couldn't agree more with that. This is a central image in Kubrick. Over and over and over again, he's telling us that reality is a kind of a movie that's being projected, and he is fusing us with the film itself by the way in which he creates an image that extends what's going on in the movie directly into the theater. This is an extraordinary thing that he does. Kubrick actually hated the concept of 3D. He did, and it's obvious why he did it, because he made 3D movies in 2D. He actually made 4D movies in 2D. This is a fact. He projects his film right on top of the viewer. Obviously, ideally, you want to see this on as big a screen as possible so that you're, in a sense, a little bit smaller than the image that is projected towards you. But that's technical, obviously. Seeing them on a reasonable-sized screen can have just as great an effect, especially if you're close up, like on a computer and studying the thing or something like that. It's almost as if the movie continues on behind you in some way. And this is all carefully orchestrated by Kubrick. So to get to this idea of 17, then, all right? Now, what I mentioned is that I considered Sirius the exterior limit. So if you see that, like that so-called blown-up bagel, it represents both the interior of the toroid shape, which has been blown up to what I call a fat toroid, basically. And then inside of that would be the interior curvature. The entire interior curvature of that would be the star Sirius, basically. We would imagine it from our central point as the interior of a massive sphere. But that's because the hole that's at the center that actually runs out at the top and bottom and poles, making a donut shape, is too small for us to see. So we just see the sphere. This is the thing called the hypersphere that we're living in that creates this Valis loop, basically. So, and the concept is it breakable or not? That's interesting enough as it is. But in regards to 17, like, I've never made the connection between Sirius and 17 before. But if you can agree with me that Sirius, because of its size, conceptually represents, at least in regards to our discussion, an external limit of sorts, then check this out as an idea. So you have these 17 U-turns in The Shining, right? Okay, so, and each one of them, if you make a study, you'll make the connection between some of them very quickly. You'll make a study that they really represent the 17 Apollo missions, basically, right? Each one of which is a U-turn, right? It goes up in the air and then it comes back down in a slightly different place because of the motion of the Earth. So these 17 U-turns are our 17 attempts to breach this limit, basically, this exterior. This is just a theory, mind you, and I'm more than willing to have it criticized. So please don't hesitate. So you have these 17 attempts. Now, what's very interesting about the number 17, and this is going to be my final thought on this, and Alan, I think you're going to dig this, quite frankly, because if we're talking about a limit here, a limit of number of different ways in which a tape and could move along this cubical interior surface. How many different types of twists and turns could it take in a U-turn? Well, the answer to that is actually 17. Check this out. 17 is the exact number of mathematical repeating systems that can be turned into wallpaper.
Excuse me, could you repeat that?
Yeah.
Kind of broke
up. Okay. 17 is what?
Well, in terms of math, you know how, like, let's say you have wallpaper, right? And that wallpaper has a pattern on it. You can have the same thing in a pattern floor. There are only 17 possible different types of patterns that exist that can create a repeating pattern without having to have breaks.
Really?
And of course, this thing gets rolled up into a tape, right? So what we have here is there's only 17, that's the maximal number. And in A Clockwork Orange, we're introduced to the number 17 because of the band name Heaven 17. And this is what I think Kubrick's talking about. Heaven being the external limit, right? Being the absolute extreme limit to which we can possibly reach. Well, it just happens to mimic the number of times that we have attempted in U-turns to go up to the moon and establish ourselves on the exterior of that moon, basically. And then this ties in to the very interesting and not easy to dismiss theory that Kubrick might have faked some images of man on the surface of the moon. Whether or not the moon landings themselves are faked is another matter. Because it may be true here, in regards to the ends of time, that somehow human beings managed to puncture the internal surface of Sirius and stand upon the external surface somehow, in some way. And there are a lot of great works of art to touch on this. We could go on about it for some time. But anyway, that's my theory. So you guys can kick it around a bit here. I'm interested in what you have to say.
I'm interested in the card, the star, and how there's this emphasis in the book of Crow's Book of the Law of Saudi not being the star, and then equating it with Hay, which is the final Hay of Tetragrammaton, which is the Shekhinah, and then attributing Saudi to the emperor. So that there's this, so if you take, you know, Sirius as the fishhook, there's really interesting things going on there.
Oh,
you look at the fact that you have the Anubis dogs there guarding on the moon card, and then obviously the star card, you have this like infinite loop actually being portrayed where the character is actually pouring from the vessel, and you have this whole idea of self-mirroring or whatever. But
okay, well, this is good. I got a kind of a Kubrick answer that you might dig because of your knowledge of Kabbalah. Check this out. So maybe we are talking about somehow flipping a toroid inside out, creating a mirror image somehow, and that would be the hyperdimensional, the next hyperdimensional level that we could go to. Well, you mentioned how Crowley switches around hay with Sadi, right? Well, check this out, man. Check this out. Right? It's there in Kubrick, in the scene where Alice shocks Bill with her love affair story. She uses the word he, right? The masculine he, and she emphasizes that word in her da-da-da-da-da. She's always ha-ha-ha, right? Well, you may know that hay means window.
Sure.
But it also means seed, right? It also means seed. So you have, and both of those come straight from the Torah, from the five books. So you don't have to go outside of that to find the correlation there. So you got seed and window. So she's saying hay over and over and over again, right? Right. Well, it's a hay seed, right? So we're talking about a window to another world being opened up somehow. That's what's happening when she delivers that speech. She's actually poking open there's some kind of magic going on there, I think, that is attempting to poke something through that window, basically. And there may have been a window of opportunity for that. And, of course, that could get us all into the whole September 11th kind of stuff, too. But it's just pretty interesting that is there in Kubrick. So if you have then – so Hay would have been the emperor before, but now it gets switched to the star. So maybe what that's literally doing is – and you, David – I do not have the knowledge of the tree of life to do this visually, but could there be some kind of fulcrum that's happened there where everything on there has been turned on one specific point? You understand? It's like all of the energy of the tree of life has been redirected in a certain direction through one of the 10 houses, possibly the moon, right?
Well, there's this whole thing that I could just be on one, and I don't know. But okay. So Alan had mentioned earlier the whole thing of the beetle and this guy talking about the beetles or whatever with the yellow beetle at the beginning of The Shining on going to the Sun Road. I find it interesting that there's way more luggage that could ever actually fit in that beetle. And how if you're equating this beetle with the yellow submarine and the whole statement that people really actually identified with, very strange, like it's so fucking random, but we all live in a yellow submarine. It's this whole thing being suggested, but then it's like we all couldn't fit in the yellow submarine, and so it's almost like there's like a club, so to speak. And so this is what I've found with the Golden Dawn, which is actually, you know, the Golden Dawn represents itself as the tree. Oftentimes they'll show you the tree and then they'll have Tiferet in the center of the tree as being the sun that is the rising sun, you know, and there's this whole thing. But then that's Za'er and not the Shekhinah. They have the right, which is appropriate in a sense, even though the sun wasn't originally equated with Tiferet, but rather Gevurah, I believe. And then obviously Chesed was the moon. But I find this whole thing, like with the European occultists, they seem to have this like notion of like almost like a club and like or echelon or a ruling elite kind of idea that gets emphasized. And so they took the same dynamics of where you have this pyramid dynamic and you're expressing like a double tetrahedron and all this stuff you'll find in this like 16th, 17th. Century Kabbalistic text, but then it's like taken in this whole different way for the European occultists, and like they'll reference Ramak, but they'll never say it's from Ramak, and they'll reference like classic like Kabbalists, but then they present it like Israel Regarde is very he commonly does that. Well, he'll take something from some like deeply rooted thing, but then he presents it as his own, and then he proceeds to twist it. And the way that it's twisted is like almost like rationalizing like elitism, which is really weird. So I think that's what I see in a lot of Kubrick stuff, is kind of like this pointing out of how the thing could be taken either way. You could take it as a secret society, like Eyes Wide Shut, and control, mind control, and all this stuff, like A Clockwork Orange. But then you could also take it in the grander sense. So Crowley seems to have switched things around very, very deliberately, and I wonder if that's like the joke. Like, you have the gold room echelon, and then you have, like, you know, the regular Joe, like Jack is, wanting to be part of that echelon, but not really. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Doesn't in Eyes Wide Shut, doesn't he also arrive at the for all intents and purposes, the gold room in a yellow cab? He's also in a yellow chariot.
Sure.
Well, this is fantastic, because there's when you mention how you're really onto something. Well, in my opinion, David, when you're talking about how this is packaged in a different way for European occultists, that's a dead on important point, I think, because check this out, right? So this is all in Rob Adger, right? Adger interprets somehow, intuits somehow, and I think correctly, that A Clockwork Orange has something to do with the formation of the European Union. If you've read his complete work on A Clockwork Orange, he makes that almost as the triumph of the entire work, basically, having to do with the color cards that flash at the beginning of the film. His theory is pretty good, and I was quite impressed by it. But now that you said this, this really almost backs him up, because check this out. So Europe is symbolized in the occult by what? By a woman breaching a bull, right? You know that
Europa.
Yeah. She's riding the waves on the bull, right? So now the term bull and the term toroid mean the same thing, Taurus. So the shape of the so-called donut that I've been talking about, or that I represent in my moon, is this Taurus. So now this might actually explain the exact reason why it is that the European occult movement was pointed in this particular direction of elitism, because there needed to be a point on it to breach this toroid, basically. So that the woman would ride on top of the bull instead of...
No, just really quickly, Taurus, the sign Taurus, is May 1st.
Nice. Yeah, okay, that makes sense, too, because now she gives birth to the double-M'd monstrosity of Marilyn Manson. Yeah, that's fantastic. And Mickey Mouse as well. Yeah. And, of course, you know, you can see a lot of... If you're into the whole kind of... the culture of the underbelly of early Nazism, and the whole the deep leathers that they wore, and the whole kind of pseudo homosexual thing that goes over top of it, and you can compare that directly with Marilyn Manson and this, and not just him but others like him. I think Lady Gaga represents the female antipode, or the female reflection of that, basically.
Well, she's the Scarlet Lady for sure. That's what Gaga means. Yeah. Gaga came from Radio Gaga, and then you have Radio Gaga Metropolis all through Queen's video. She's actually literally named after Metropolis, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, it's not a far leap at all.
Gaga would be the noise that we make in Babylon, right? Where everything we said was just, and it, where everything we
said. Babylon.
Yeah, we've lost our speech. And now we've reversed.
Check this out. At the end of Metropolis, what do they say? Is the balance between the head and the hands is the heart. Well, if you take the head and the hands as places on the tree of life, it's again placing that the focal point again in a spinning mechanism.
Oh, yeah. I have something for you, Mark. Okay, so I've been studying this just the last few weeks with my rabbi. Well, I mean, we've come to this point where basically we're looking at the hand in symbolism, and that they have this whole thing with the hand. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 segments to the hand, right, of the fingers, excuse. So, which is really interesting that they emphasize this in 16th century Kabbalah. They're like, there's 14 segments. You have 14 plus 14, you have 28, and then what is that? The value of, I'm not remembering, but there's this whole sequence with the 14 relating then to the cube of space. Because if you look at the Rosicrucian cross, which is the cube of space unfolded, you have 14 segments that surround it. And there's this parallel that gets repeated between the Rosicrucian cross, which is the cube of space, and the hand. And then you have the yud, which is 10, right? It literally means a hand, but it's an open hand. And then kaf, which is the next one, you have 20 in Gematria, equals the closed fist. And so that's the Wheel of Fortune, which is the turnaround.
Yes. Turn around and cough. Sorry. if you know what I'm saying, turn around and cough.
Turn your head and cough. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Marker, so it's like turning around. It's that spinning.
Oh my God,
spinning.
That's extraordinary. That is fantastic. I totally love it.
Now you mentioned the 14 pieces. So for me, I can't hear 14 without thinking of Osiris, the segments of Osiris, the 14 segments of Osiris. Now, when you talk about, there's the old joke about, you know, your girlfriend, Rosie Palm. Uh-huh. You ever heard, you know, like, oh yeah, last night I got it on with Rosie Palm. And,
Rosie Palm, nice.
Yeah, you know, it's like, so it's the Rosicrucian, just bring that all in there together.
Yeah, Mary Jane Rottencrotch. Oh, sorry.
Which actually...
Rosemary Jane Rotten...
No, that's... This goes right to the whole spitting on the cross thing, too, right?
Oh, the trick where they ask them to spit on the cross, and if they
Sure, because this is spitting on the cross. No. I'm not saying that I don't promulgate such an idea as a practice, but I'm saying that spitting on the cross was something that was accused of the Templars
right,
as a part of the reason that you got that. And so if you take the cross, you know, in Dante's, in the Divine Comedy, Dante places the cross at the bottom of a sphere. Like he actually places the crucifixion of Christ directly at the bottom of a sphere. So, which he calls the globe. That's how he sees reality. So that becomes a three-dimensional glyph for the symbol for the planet Venus, right? Which is a circle with a cross at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So the idea of spitting on the cross then becomes the sexual union, right? The male and the female, basically. Which is different than the way in which the image of Mars and Venus are usually paired up, which is with the circles overlapping. So this is... To me, something that represents a twisting of space that's taking place here, right?
Sure.
They're actually twisting the idea. They're twisting the emphasis of Mars and Venus, or not they. I mean, who are they? What are we talking about? But there seems to be some kind of motion of changing the direction of things through the sexual act between a male and a female, and then the way in which it's flipped around into either homoerotic or masturbatory imagery as well. Yeah, I mean, to me, this is quite fascinating. And when I say homoerotic and masturbatory, what I'm talking about is Crowley, right? Because the concept of the 11 representing the magician, the male magician, and his wand in his hand, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Crowley directly associated the concept of the wand and its positive and negative forces with the penis, right? So it's all
and
pretty
Jesus,
fascinating.
Jesus gets nailed in the palm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Getting nailed is getting fucked. I'm getting fucked in the palm means.
Yeah. Oh. Nice. Yeah. Absolutely. So the cross becomes a masturbatory symbol.
Right. And so, my question is: isn't a spit, you know, like a rotisserie? Isn't that also a spit? Is to turn, like to turn the spit. To spin the cross.
Yeah, and that creates at least. In one manifestation, the world card, right? Because you have the female with the two erect phalluses that she's holding in each hand, representing some kind of electrical current. So, I mean, we're talking about all these things here. To me, I see these things intuitively, but I don't have a grasp on them scientifically to say what is the difference between one type of current and another and what sort of effect does it have. But to me, taking everything back to the work of Kubrick and this idea of 17 representing the complete mathematical total of all different types of tape pattern that can exist and be repeated on a tape without any glitches, right?
Oh.
What you have... Go ahead.
Mark, you just said you don't understand the difference between the currents, did you say?
Yeah, currents. Yeah,
As in like electrical currents?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
So I make the point... it's really weird, but... Whatever, I'm just going to say, so I would gladly send it to you, what I sent to Bill and David. They've seen what I've written so far of the Kingkill book I'm working on, but it deals very much, you know, I keep making this point in my blog that there's this corollary is the spin wheel, the Catherine wheel, it's this direct corollary to all this stuff. So, you know, this is, again, your spinning motion, this is all these things, and I make the point that I see the strength card, it's the 77 or the 777 as this I refer to it as an alternating current. It's this rise and fall. It's a very sexual act, and I'm saying it's yin and yang. It's rise and fall. But I make the point that it's an alternating current. I have a line in there. It's a power like an alternating current. Now it occurs to me that when you said you're not sure if this type of current, I realize there's two types of current that, as it was developed, was a direct current and an alternating current, or a DC and an AC. So here we see like DC with like this direct sort of power by fiat, right? DC being the center of direct power, directed current, and AC I have to think of Alistair, right? The alternating current.
Okay. Very interesting. So direct current means that, but isn't that actually kind of almost true in reverse? Because the DC current goes only one way. It would be like a fire hose in a sense of current, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like it's power by fiat. That's your, you know, here's your DC. I'm thinking Washington, DC.
But the actual, but that doesn't describe the normal sexual union. You see, it almost seems like
no,
AC.
I'm saying DC, direct current is like, you know, kind of like missionary sort of like missionary position or perhaps some sort of rape, but it's like a dominant, like one way. It's sexual power in one way. I'm dominating you or something like that. Whereas
right.
alternating current
okay,
is,
I
the
see
given,
what you're saying.
Is the give and take of a true sexual union.
Mm-hmm. See, my problem with that is just strictly speaking in terms of the actual data and the way in which we value alternating current as being a male-female thing, right? Like, that's what's on your wall. That's your AC connection. Your DC connection is a battery in which power it spurts out of the battery. Okay, yeah, see, there's a lot of stuff that's worthy of study here because you could look at the plus-minus configuration and sort of figure out the way in which it flows, obviously.
Absolutely.
So the DC battery, the DC is a phallus in a sense then.
Steve Wilner, I don't know if you guys have ever listened to his Cracks in the Wall podcast. They're fucking,
I haven't, no.
Oh my yeah. God.
I like
phenomenal.
Steve. I like Steve a lot, and his work is fantastic.
Everyone, take a week off of your life. Google Cracks in the Wall, Steve Wilner. There's only 7 episodes. They're like an hour each. And it's actually only 6 of them are done with this guy who calls himself Will777. They're just fucking phenomenal. So it's like 6 hours. 6 hours of audio. Find 6 hours in your life. They're so fucking good. So they go into this idea of battery. And one of the things they're discussing is the battery connection and the copper top. He's talking about this idea that he says in the Bible, Jesus is given acid. There's a point where Jesus is given acid, and not like LSD, although we could take it that way if we wanted to play with it. But this idea that Jesus asks for water and someone gives him acid, and this idea of that Jesus as a battery, and then they also play with this idea of that you call police. This is one thing they say: police are called coppers because they have the copper top battery, and we call police cops. We call them coppers, and then you have this idea of like assault and battery, that salt mm-hmm. is needed to have a battery, so you have a salt and battery, so battery as both a beating but also a, this is again a display of power.
I mean, this is the thing. Isaac Newton apparently discovered this when he was looking at the Greek myths. He felt that they actually, each myth described a very discrete chemical process. And he worked his life trying to figure out exactly what they were. Like the idea of Venus being caught in the net, apparently, is representative of an actual account. All of this stuff gets down to where you're starting to talk about, you know, should I rent a forge somewhere and start learning metallurgy? I mean, it almost seems to be at that level. And it's funny that's, you know, just taking it back to the idea of film itself. And the idea of the schizophrenia of the act of watching a movie and being in it at the same time, and then the idea of Tony and the idea of Shining and the way it all fits together in The Shining, it's so mind-numbingly mind-boggling that I can't help but wonder if it's not meant to spin you out of control, almost, you know, like it's almost like something Kubrick was a part of a mechanism to try and kind of amp up human thinking. This is and push it into very strange new directions, or to make very firm connections between things. And of course, this is exactly what Kubrick said when he accepted the D.W. Griffith Award, right? I mean, this is about not about being overly cautious, but the myth of Icarus is actually figuring out how to punch our way all the way to the sun, essentially, how to build the right kind of machine so that we can achieve that. So, you know, I feel like I'm at a very, very low level in all of this in regards to any contribution I make, but I'm still fascinated beyond almost beyond words.
Let me bring up a quick point, something that I just learned this week. I was reading the Stanley Kubrick Archives section on The Shining. I don't know if any of you have that book or have had a chance to read that. But they have some images of Kubrick's copy of The Shining with his notes in it.
Yeah.
But they also have a few photographs of the galleys of The Shining, which is the unpublished rough copy.
Right.
And so it says The Shine by Stephen King. And there are notes by Stanley Kubrick on those.
So he actually had a galley print of,
yes,
of Stephen King. Oh, my God.
Like, right?
Who the hell did this guy know to get that?
Well, like, okay, so this is what freaks me out, is that I knew about the published copy with all his notes, but I've never heard anyone explicitly, unless it went over my head, explicitly state the fact that Kubrick read Stephen King's The Shine before it was even published.
Or you have to entertain, that's not necessarily true. He could have gotten an early copy to try and figure out what was the, no pun intended.
No. It says in the book that Kubrick had it, that it was given to him as something that he might be interested in, that he worked on the red book before it came out. Yeah.
Carl Jung's The Red Book he has on fucking Ullman's desk. Like, that shit, it wasn't published for like another 10 years or something.
Well, what is the scrapbook that Jack has by his side as he's trying to turn that into a new work of art, right?
Yeah, that's Kubrick, all about the murders in the fucking hotel.
Kubrick has the unpublished Shining, and he's working on possibly turning it into a movie before it's even published. And I just have to wonder, what if The Shining did not become the mainstream bestseller that it did become? Would Kubrick have dismissed it? Would he have not gone?
I don't think so, because a lot, like you know, a lot of his like Full Metal Jacket's based off a book that wasn't as big as The Shining. You know, a lot of his, why can't I think of Barry Lyndon? You know, like a lot of these things, like these aren't huge mainstream books. I don't think.
I agree with Alan here. I mean, King was already a mega novelist. His two previous books, Carrie and Salem's Lot, both did super good on the old bestseller list. They were churning out copies faster than they could print them. So, and Kubrick was, you know, he had his ear to the ground on that kind of stuff. So I suspect that he probably had a good feeling that the novel might be successful anyway. But Alan's definitely right. I mean, Barry Lyndon isn't exactly a bestseller either. But the idea that he had a galley print interests me, because like that would mean that he was thinking about optioning the work before it was published, if he actually had a pre-publication galley print. So that's pretty interesting, because the term galley, right, is also a kitchen. So I just think that that's kind of a neat pun there. What he might have, you know, there might have been something there in the fact that that particular piece of information is included in the Kubrick archive, because I think Kubrick's throwing lots of clues everywhere, not just in his films, but in pretty much everything the guy was the chess player of chess players, it appears. So that's just a thought anyway.
Well, it also goes on to discuss Kubrick's opinion of King's writing, and that what he thought about The Shining, and that he said that he didn't really think that Stephen King was necessarily a great writer, but that he was a very good architect and that he was someone who could invent very good ideas, but that he also felt that King kind of, he assumed in his reading of King's material that it's something that King wrote once, maybe went over it one more time, but then moved on to the next section of the book. That he didn't really stay in one place and obsess over particular sections of the book, that he just sort of let it rip, which is the antithesis of Kubrick's style of creating. I just find that Kubrick saw that there was, he saw the book The Shining, or what Stephen King had created, as sort of like a hotel to move into and create something grand. That,
well, I mean, I would add more to that, because all of this fitting in with this whole idea, this paradigm of somehow, I'm taking it back to a very deep level, this piercing of and turning inside out of reality. I don't remember who it was that said it. It might have been the blogger Johnny53, who has written pretty extensively about The Shining. But this idea that I think Kubrick might have said it himself, and I'm not 100% sure, but that he didn't just change The Shining, he turned it inside out. That's what he said he did. He said there's something going on here that is, to me, very indicative of somebody with a superhuman knowledge of reality. And I'm not saying that as a fan, for, you know, I think you guys know me well enough to know that, but I'm definitely with a person who's literally in dumbstruck with the kind of subtlety and depth. I mean, this is the thing, like, why I think that Kubrick has to be come back to more than anybody else, is because he made it a public fact that he did everything he could to control every element of his. I mean, think about these people doing 115 takes and wondering what in hell it was he was trying to capture. I mean, and of course, never telling them why either. That's the point. Keeping every secret. You know, and the fact that we talk about Kubrick in such a way, and that he has this many secrets in him, to me makes him like almost the ultimate English language dungeon master, essentially. You know, it's a game that he's put us up against to try and break our way out of his Rubik's Cube.
Well, and also, if Kubrick is looking for, if he's looking for vehicles to say something or to make his commentary, a work like King's The Shining, which he is basically quoted as saying, you know, basically it was, he's great about plot construction, but he doesn't care about the writing. Well, he's constructed something that King can go into and put that spark into it, to make that uncanny ability to make something inanimate alive.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, The Shining does seem to be almost, it's hard to say that one film or another is of Kubrick's is really better, because the guy was just so great at making a movie, but he does seem to be playing with this idea of a puzzle more than in any other film than in The Shining. Like, every image is so packed with like minutia and detail. Only Eyes Wide Shut comes close to that. But the interesting thing about it is that The Shining was already a popular novel. So it was likely, and it's a horror genre film. I mean, everything about it has this power of a vortex, basically, The Shining, to suck people in and hold them there, which is the exact purpose of The Overlook itself. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing when you're talking about a work of art. I mean, and maybe when it comes to this kind of stuff. Like, and so is everybody else in this group in a certain sense. In regards to the mainstream thought, we're almost like the Galileos of our generation, and I'm not trying to pat us on our back, because we're probably not going to be very well rewarded for it, as Galileo wasn't in his lifetime. But, you know, for people who hear this, yeah, and who are wondering about Kubrick, I mean, this guy is an artist on par with Da Vinci. He's a genius on par with M.C. Escher or with Einstein, even, in my opinion. So, you know, that's my rant. That's my Kubrick rant for the episode.
You know that Warner Brothers offered Kubrick the opportunity to direct The Exorcist.
Oh, wow, what a movie that would have been.
they offered him the opportunity to direct both The Exorcist and The Exorcist II, which he passed on. Now, what's odd is that the great party man in The Shining, he was the editor on the film editor for The Exorcist.
Yes, you mentioned that. That's fascinating.
Which I don't even get that. But what that speaks to possibly is Kubrick.
Did he edit The Exorcist 2 as well, or just the first one?
I just know he edited the first one. I think that was the one he did.
I'll have to check that out, because he's a British guy, and The Exorcist 2 is directed by a British filmmaker, so that's kind of interesting.
So for Kubrick, someone who's going to take, it's sort of like you said, like a Da Vinci or a Raphael. Like, if you're going to do a sculpture, and you're going to do a masterpiece, and you inspect the slab of marble that you're going to use to begin your sculpture, it has to be the right slab. It has to be, you have to start with something that you know you can work with. So obviously there was something about The Exorcist that he saw that was not a good starting point.
Well, how about, I mean, I don't know what Kubrick's prejudice would have been, but you are aware of William, I don't know how you pronounce his name, William Blatty? Blady?
Yep.
You are familiar with his CIA connections, right?
No.
Well, yeah, go on, Alan. You got to hear this.
Yeah, just do some simple Googling around William Blatty, CIA. I mean, he did his most recent book was some sort of CIA book, and I take back the statement of his most recent book, because I actually don't remember. This was a while back. But yeah, I had basically was interested in him for a different reason, and then I stumbled upon that he has all these deep CIA connections.
How do you spell it?
Blatty.
Oh.
Okay, well, you know, Matt, may I continue take off from there, Alan, on this?
Sure, yeah, I wanted to throw that out there, because it seems like let's pretend for a minute that there is obviously some correlation, whether or not Jay Widener is completely right or not, there is some correlation between Kubrick trying to encode something about this moon landing. It's very obvious that that's in there. So I think that to have an actual government agent spook on, you know, it's sort of involved, and you might be too close to the source, just throwing that out. You know,
that's
you know
a
what
very
I mean?
Interesting idea, yeah. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I mean, you know that Blatty is a Jesuit priest as well, eh?
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, he's a full-blooded Jesuit. He is, I've forgotten what they call it when they actually christen someone a priest. What is that? Yeah, I can't think of it right now. But he's a Jesuit. It's very interesting that you mentioned that, because the Blatty connection. Because Blatty wrote a novel called Kiss Me or something. Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane.
Yeah, the mental institution with the fucking.
That's right. That's right. And there's a scene in that story that's about an astronaut, and he freaks out on the moon. And in the film, which is directed by Blatty himself, this astronaut is standing before a monolith, a black monolith, and he's screaming, "There's nothing there, there's nothing there, there's nothing there." So I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, totally. I was tripping out on, there's so many levels to that thing. You could spend some time with
the film is. The film is called The Ninth Configuration, usually, but sometimes it's called Twinkle Twinkle Killer King. Yeah,
which I watched because of.
Twinkle. Sorry, no, just to say, Twinkle Twinkle, we have again our star, our shining, our blazing star, our all this sort of
serious
stuff.
Yeah.
Right, but that's serious, or what, you know, again, so your shining, twinkling, blazing star killing the king is to me. I assume that's a pretty obvious correlation there to all things Philip K. Dick and Robert Anton Wilson and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Very interesting. You know, I'm thinking of this in terms of the Dog Days too, right?
Precisely, yeah.
The Dog Days are what period?
Starts 723.
Okay, so there you go. Well, Well, the 237th day of the year is August 25th. So there you have it. Yeah. Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
And you are, there's some sort of thing where there is a DC, the city of DC is supposed to have some sort of like a planetary alignment around that time. I believe it's in August. I have the notes here somewhere. But there is in somewhere within the dog days, the city, the layout of DC has the Federal Triangle has a planetary alignment. Hold on, I think I might have it. August 10th. Okay, I think if this is right, August 10th to 14th, to match with the rising of Venus, which of course is our copper and all sorts of things like that. But yeah. also within that August window.
Well, I've got an interesting idea here. I wanted to, because just what you just kind of unfurled there, Alan, just something popped into my head about DC, and you said an alignment with Sirius. Mm-hmm. And before we were talking about how the DC current is strictly male, it's one way, it's like, you know, just a positive, like a fire hose, so to speak. It doesn't go anywhere particularly. So you have the Washington Monument. Well, now, stick with me here for a second. What if the Washington Monument is the top of a dreidel,
basically? Mm-hmm.
And what if that dreidel is on its natural spin, you know, totally balanced for a period of time, and then it begins to lose its polarity and starts to tilt a little. So what happens is that the top of the dreidel begins to move in a circle, right? So then something has to come in and grab that dreidel, and I'm guessing that this is Isis, right? Refashed. So what we have is the stable dreidel represents Osiris before he is chopped off. That's the motion that sets that the action that sets this previously stable dreidel into a spinning at the top, so that its top point begins to make a circle rather than. And that's funny because the circle could represent the vesica in a sense too. So now the dreidel has been feminized; it doesn't have a phallus anymore. And then
pause.
And then the star. Go ahead.
Just to say. I've talked about it a few times on this show. I don't know if, Mark, we've ever discussed it, but there was a 1985 film called Explorers, which...
Yes, I remember the film, yeah.
Right, so it has Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix. I mean, like, just so fucking loaded, the Hawk of Horus and Phoenix and blah, blah, blah. And the kid gets this extraterrestrials beam him the blueprints to build a spaceship to go see them. Right. And when you were talking about this, the tilt of the spin, my mind just went, tilt-a-whirl. And then I was like, wait a second. In the Explorers film, the kids get the blueprints to build a fucking spaceship from their telepathic ETs sending them transmissions, a la Sirius, and they build it out of a tilt-a-whirl.
Oh,
just gotta
wild.
Fucking tell you that.
Wild. That's fantastic. So there you have it. And then... The star Sirius reaching down, supposedly killing the king in one respect, restabilizes that dreidel temporarily.
Perhaps. Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's the star Sirius, which is the star now coming in and becoming the phallus, the shape of her celestial hand maybe stabilizing it again.
And I assume everyone here is familiar with the idea that the major points of DC represent the hieroglyph for Sirius.
Sure.
Hieroglyph for Sirius, yeah, is that just common knowledge? I just want to throw that out.
I didn't know that, but that's very
the hieroglyph for Sirius is an obelisk, a star, and a dome. So you have your Washington Monument, your Pentagon, and your Capitol Dome. The if you actually take an overhead view of the city of DC, it is the hieroglyph for Sirius.
Totally. And so River Phoenix, shortly after being in Explorers, was in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which centers around the Holy Grail. But the beginning of it takes place in Zion National Park, and he ends up on the train falling into the pit of snakes which, like, right. That's almost like hieroglyphic in communicating, like, the level of what, you know, the significance of that. But, like, you're talking about current earlier, and I mean, currency is taken to be another kind of current. Like, even, like, the origin of currency, it's like silver was to gold as the moon was to the sun in terms of the ratio value, which was kept for the longest time just because of the mathematical, like, element there. And so this the symbol for money that we have of the S on the line actually was originally an S on a Tav cross, which was symbolic of Numbers 21, where Moses puts the fucking serpent on the pole to heal the people, so that you have, like, the serpents that fell and poisoned the people, and then you have the healing serpent that was put. And so the gematria for Messiah in Hebrew is the same gematria as Nechesh for
serpent. Interestingly enough, too, David, the serpent of Moses is always stiffened, right? It's stiffened before the act is performed. So it's stiffened by his touch, essentially. So if we think of the serpents, as we discussed before, as segments of this tape, which is a tape loop, we're going back to Valis loop. What Moses is really doing as becoming the master of the serpent himself is he's turning time back into linear time, right? He's reimposing a so-called perfect order of linear time as discussed in the book of Genesis, right? Which is not a time loop as put forth by Christ, right? So in a sense, it seems like we're almost talking about how reality goes from a one-dimensional object, like the point on a piece of paper. So now what Moses is doing is it's almost like he's rolling up the map, in a sense. So the different parts of the map touch each other, right? And different and different parts of the tape are touching each other. Oh, here's John. He's coming in.
Groovy.
Hey, John.
Welcome back. Did he just?
Are we all here?
What happened?
What's up?
Is Alan here?
What happened?
We lost Alan, I think.
I dialed in. I may have tripped some sort of trapdoor somewhere.
He's in the Rancor pit? Shit.
Yeah, literally.
It's interesting because John came in at 2:17 on my clock.
I'm staying at the real Overlook Hotel.
Hello?